I'll reconvene here. Now, just before we begin to do the debate, I just thank you for going that way. Mr. Barr, we had had a discussion earlier in the afternoon, agreement between the four of us, and while we haven't clearly made any final decision, we think that the Waikiki Airport would be better dealt with in the district plan, with a zoning separate from the rural zone, and we think that it would be appropriate for the council to address us in its reply as to how that could occur, whether it's within the scope or needs variation, etc. Thank you. What's your, that's what you call a heads up.
For quite a few of the matters that were raised during that.
Yes, to be clear, I think that all of the matters that were raised should be dealt with in one pit as well, in the same thing. To be fair, we had concerns as to jurisdiction to grant the submission in respect of the refund. I don't think it was clearly identified for affected persons. That would be dealt with in the same mechanism for whichever the council chooses.
Can I just require something like a whole package of...
Thank you, Judge. Each of the other matters you mentioned, the refer, as well as the zoning or not of one degree of order.
Sorry.
He's rubbing his hands.
Yeah. No, it's okay. So you said the other matters, and you talked about the, obviously the one of the airport zoning and then the runway protection area.
Yes.
But there's also other matters raised in the submission, but not so much so. There's like a few sort of matters to do with
infrastructure. No, it's not to do with one of the airport. Not
the religion.
That's not the broad matters that UAC is concerned about.
Yeah, I get it. Thank you.
To see that shorter than Mr. Goldsmith.
Oh, yes. Yes, and I do apologise for the late.
All right, they are double sided.
You may not have had a chance to read them, but.
We haven't.
No, okay, no, I won't speak too brief. I won't read them with words, I will just speak to them. But if you consider that I'm tipping over something that you'd rather give me to be honest, let me give me an old. And I'll focus on it a bit more explicitly. So we'll crack on. Is everyone with a copy?
Yes.
Here for the board of the people who come to hear what we've got to say. So, the two gentlemen on either side of me, you know, Mr. Vivian, and this is Mr. Gray, Gary Gray, who's one of the directors of New Zealand Customs. So he's going to be presenting his evidence that you would have pre-read on mining and what's been contemplated as it relates to the rural chapter. What I've said in paragraph 1.4 is I'm adopting the legal submissions from Mr. Goldsmith on four points. In terms of hearing process, this ongoing conversation we're having about the topic of scope, collective scope, the general concept of diversification in the rural zone, and the case law of existing and future environments. And because of the time we've got today, I'm not proposing to address you on those points. You will be addressed at least twice this week by Mr. Goldsmith and probably myself when we're back on Wednesday on those same points, where clients have got bigger and different issues at stake that relate to these four points. So I just did want to note for the record that I'm adopting those permissions that have been given to you later this week. But because of time, I think we better use with our questions of these two gentlemen rather than conversing those issues.
John Smith going to deal with the response to the council, by the council, of this issue of scope as raised in the first hearing stream?
Yes, so he is addressing Mr. Winchester's submission. We have addressed Mr. Winchester's submissions on the points in detail.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's fine.
So I'll
save any questions.
Have a go at it. Yes.
Mr. Colson.
So page two, what I did on page two, mainly for the benefit of Commissioners Coombs and Lawson, is really summarise points that we made in the hearing stream one, because they both, you know, they're all relevant to each other. And so we set out there the six key points that we were trying to make at the strategic level and the landscape chapter level. So very briefly, paragraph A, what we were seeking was that the plan framework better allow for future mining operations to be assessed on their merits on a case-by-case basis. And just on that point, I will note that we're not seeking any, apart from the topic of mining buildings, we're not seeking any changes to the rules in the rural chapter. So we're not seeking a more permissive rural framework. Mining is, as notified, was discretionary, not seeking any narrowing or reduction in activity status. It's really just the policy and objective framework that a mining proposal gets assessed on a case-by-case basis that we're seeking some amendments to. So that's really what I mean by on the merits on a case-by-case basis. And a theme that will come through is that, you know, the minerals are where they are. And so if what we're worried about is that the provisions of the plan at a strategic level and then in the rural chapter don't accidentally sterilise the ability to have access to those minerals without, you know, very good justification. And if it does so, it's not only the RMA benefits that can't be taken into account, it's also the whole purpose of the Crown Minerals Act that gets frustrated, and the royalties that the Crown gets from those minerals. So that's
what the matter we have taken into account?
It's a matter you can take into account, I'd say, as a relevant matter. It has to be looked at when you consider economic benefits. One of the economic benefits from mining are the royalties to the Crown. Where is the Crown owned mineral? Not every mineral is a Crown owned mineral, but the ones might find concern about.
I suppose in theory that's public interest. I think I've really noticed that any great benefit to those of us in the public from
the Crown's income. Yes. I mean, I know that there is a great benefit in terms of the income from royalties and the effect nationally. But we haven't tried to quantify that for the purpose of this hearing, and I know that neither did Stratera. It is one of the benefits that is out there that we're just trying to maintain the opportunities for. And then point C, which is related to that mining is a significant contributor to the New Zealand economy, and that's not just in terms of royalties, that's obviously in terms of the jobs and so on.
Ms. Blake-Kelly, when you're talking about this sterilising it, is that, are you referring to the plan sterilising the ability for mining to occur, or that the plan puts in place provisions that would allow other parties to basically effectively sterilise where minerals might be, and therefore potential access to that in terms of mining at a later stage?
Both are relevant on that sterilisation topic. So to take your last point first, and you're probably familiar with some of the provisions in the Octave RP stuff, particularly about that form of sterilisation where activities such as subdivision might be enabled without consideration for the fact that it's nearby or on top of a mining resource, and then it is sterilised because the development on top of it. So then that physical sterilisation.
So that's the octopus.
That's the octopus that particularly focus. Well, and that's one that at the moment you do have to give the most weight to, you do have to give back to it. And so that's why we haven't paid as much attention to the proposed RPS. We'll see what it says.
But the purpose of my questions is, I think possibly by the time we get to the end of this process, I think think the other one will at least, hopefully they'll have made some decisions.
That's right.
And I understand the September, so that's why I'm...
Yeah.
If we assume that it came out the same way, is it corrected or fixed at all from your client's perspective in terms of the proposed draft?
Yes. Well, we have to guess what it might come out as. I think if it does come out in September in the middle of this process, there probably will have to be a way to address that somehow.
I think Commissioner Sinclair's question was really if those decisions confirmed the notified duty of the proposed RDS, would that be satisfying your client's position? But I think that was what he was asking.
On this question, on the sterilisation question.
Mm.
Well, like I say, we haven't addressed it as robustly because it's a moving target. We have looked at it, and that might be another question, a question you'd be able to put to Mr. Vivian.
Okay.
He has addressed it, he's analysed it, and it's in the current court notification. But the other ways of being can sterilise a resource is by having, overly restrictive rules and objectives and policies. And we're not saying about that at the moment, they haven't sterilised it, because it's a discretionary activity. There is a nod to it in the provisions. But we are continuing to ensure that they don't get pulled in the other direction and sterilised by more restrictive provisions, or and we consider that the balance still needs to be pulled back towards more explicit acknowledgement of the importance of mining both historically and in the future.
This might be covering well into advance, but in my understanding is from reading the evidence that tungsten type mining is underground type mining.
Yes.
Is there a difference between it being discretionary activity and going the other way, NCA, non-compliant activity, for things that are open cast mining, if that's the correct?
A point about mining that some people do lose sight of is a temporary activity. It's comparatively short term. It's going in there to get a known finite resource, and then it's finished and things get rehabilitated. So as techniques advance and improve, in particular the use of underground mining, the rehabilitation techniques and the risks associated with mining are less than they used to be. Sorry, excuse my breaking voice. Pointing again on the fact that mining can't choose where to go because it has to go where the resource is. And then point F sums up that the changes we seek are to protect to our concern that the proposed district plan doesn't currently recognise adequately the benefits of mining within the district, either historically or in the future. And this is an anomaly in light of the significant importance mining has played in the founding and growth of this district. The next section of my submission talks about mining as part of the existing environment. And I don't propose to actually read through that section in great detail because it really is just it's a matter of fact, setting the scene. Historically, mining is part of our existing landscape. It's acknowledged in Dr. Reed's reports and in her evidence that mining has had an influence on our landscape. Some of the mining heritage is part of our tourism attraction, brings people to the place. So it's part of the district's culture and part of what you see. Ironically, some of the authorities that Andy Tungsten will need to get will be from Heritage New Zealand to affect historic sites that are previous mining sites, and that's incredibly common to miners around the country. and obviously we'll talk about that in the heritage chapter too, but you know, that just illustrates that mining is a continuum, it's an activity that's a continuum. Once people came in and started discovering minerals in New Zealand, it is something that comes and goes. And Mr. Gray will talk quite a bit about that, the cyclic nature of mining and how it's decadal rather than unfunded industries, which are often seasonal cycles or not quite such big long-term cycles, but it is a cyclical continuous process. A couple of points that I wanted to touch on that I haven't addressed in my written submissions, but I'll get out of the way at the start. Some of the changes we're seeking are to definitions, primarily to make them consistent with the definitions in the Crown Minerals Act of mining activity, exploration, prospecting, those key terms that under the Crown Minerals Act, particular permits are issued in respect of. Under the RMA, the effects of those activities are managed. And one of the challenges that the mining industry faces in New Zealand is, and it is, I'm not saying it's an unreasonable challenge, but the fact that there are several statutes that a mining company will need authorisation under, and the better we can streamline consistency between each of those statutes, the less sort of an unnecessary inefficiency arise. And one way of ensuring consistency is that very simple level of using banking definitions to describe the activity. And this is an extremely good reason not to. Put your shoes in the feet of the shoes of the miner and think about they've got to get heritage authorities from Heritage New Zealand for archaeological sites, they've got to get their permits from Crown Minerals, they've got to get an access arrangement from DOCS, and maybe an access arrangement from the landowner as well, and resource consent. So they do all of these things, and probably other things, companies making and so on. So lots of important authorisations need to be obtained. The more consistency there is in the terminology, at the very least, between those different processes, the less of one and sort of inefficiency in the multitude of processes that they must go through. So that's where the relief we're seeking in terms of definitions stems from.
In terms of, are there any RMA reasons that, from a legal perspective, or this might also go to Mr. Vivian later, are there any things about, is it something different about the definition under the Crown Minerals Act that would separate it, or it's not the definition provided in the RMA, but as it should apply in the plan? So I think saying that they should be consistent,
yes.
But the thing is there anything that in an RMA context which would potentially need to change to make it different?
Well, not that we could see, which is why we promoted the relief we're seeking, because in terms of making sure the RMA definitions describe an activity that can then, give a particular activity status to and assess the effects of, the Crown Minerals Act definitions meet that need, meet that purpose. Section 4, diversification of activities in the rural zone. So, as I've said, we're not seeking changes to rules with the exception of buildings associated with mining. It's the objectives and policies that we're seeking further changes to so that they more explicitly provide for mining activities, but to acknowledge the historical connection as well as its importance to the district's well-being for present and future generations. I've covered off 4.2 and 4.3. So 4.4, in addition to an amended purpose statement and relatively minor reading changes to objectives, we are seeking new objectives and policies which are identified in the section A of the Vivian evidence. And the rationale for adoption of these provisions is discussed by Mr. Vivian in pages 14 to 17. Council's planning evidence adopted in part some of that submission, but has not adopted the new objectives and policies that are proposed. I put out there a quote from Mr. Barnes' report. So by my reading of Mr. Barr's rationale for not adopting the submission of New Zealand tax, and it appears to be justified both in terms of an economic analysis of benefits of mining subject to appropriate environmental forum 9. But the economic benefits cited are not discussed in Mr. Osborne's economic evidence with reference to mining. And Mr. Osborne states that there are 3.9% evidence that mining is included as a type of activity which might occur in the rural area of the district, and that the damage of concern is more likely to occur cumulatively through establishment over time, multiple activities which impact will change on the environment, and which reach a level where the collective impact is significant and reach the tipping point. Mr. Osborne's evidence then goes on to consider at length the effects of the tourism industry on the barrels in the district and the importance of safeguarding the natural landscape as an economic resource. But the above analysis is not of how the objectives of policies adequately recognise the benefits of mining, nor does Mr. Osborne acknowledge or explain how he factored in the fact that the effects of mining on the landscape are short-term and temporary, and furthermore, he does not acknowledge the footprint of a mining operation can be comparatively very small, yet will yield a very high value in terms of output. And with respect to Mr. Barr's statement about safeguarding resources in Part 2 matters, it is assumed that this is based upon the landscape evidence. However, the evidence of Dr. Reeves does not consider mining effects on landscape character other than in the context of the Upper Clutha River, where I stick out one of the quotes from your evidence there. So although it is odd that, and this is the only reference we can find in Dr. Reed's evidence on mining effects, Dr. Reed's analysis of the character of an area is based upon the litigation of that area as opposed to its landscape characteristics. The point that the temporary and historic existence of mining is not detractive from the natural unity of the landscape is important and equally valid in the northern site where New Zealand's tungsten is going to operate or is operating. Council's case for not adopting the proposed provisions of New Zealand tungsten therefore do not appear to be supported by its evidence. There is no economic basis for rejecting the relief sought by New Zealand tungsten, and no explicit evidence in terms of potentially adverse effects either. Which should be another subject in New Zealand tungsten's case. In this section, I do a brief super whistle stop tour of section 5, which I won't belabour. But in paragraph 4.13, we'll emphasise that a clear part of the section 5 purpose is the relevance of economic and social benefits of activities where there is adequate protection for the natural environment, the effects of potential employment, business, goods and services to be provided from appropriate mining activities to the district are clearly relevant. Delete consideration at paragraph 4.14, minerals are expressly excluded in section 5.2a of the Act from the requirement to sustain the potential of them to meet the reasonably foreseeable needs of future generations. And this exclusion obviously recognises the non-renewable nature of many mineral resources.
So, just before paragraph 4.14, it just says consideration at.
Yes, so that's a typo.
I'm trying to delete that.
Yes. And then 4.15, the court in Gebbie and Banks Peninsula District Council summarised the point in relation to the finite nature of mineral resources. So basically, there is no duty to manage them so that they're there for the next generation's mine. that's another fact of which.
Axiomatic,
isn't it? I'll set out one of the other key cases where the significant benefits of mining were acknowledged were weighing against important matters of national importance in Section 6A and Solar Energy, West Coast Regional Council and Bulla case. And then I go on to discuss amenity values, which are obviously one area where there could be effects of mining on local amenity values and recreation values. In 4.18, amenity values are broad and not just based on maximalist or pristine aspects. The ability for mitigation of mining sites through offsetting can provide for enhanced access and enjoyment for the public in the future to ONE barrels, which would not otherwise be able to be achieved without the economic benefits derived from mining. And this is where it may be a misunderstanding by some of the submitters, the further submitters on our submission on the offsetting proposal. It was never our intention to alter the biodiversity offsetting provisions in the biodiversity offset hierarchy, which is well established. What we're trying to achieve in our release source is that in addition to it being explicit that biodiversity offsetting is good, is that there's an agreed hierarchy that is applied within a framework, there are other effects, other values that could be impacted by mining that could also benefit from offsetting or compensation type proposals. So again, so we may have gone off on the wrong foot with some of the submitters who opposed our relief on the basis that it is fair with the biodiversity of setting hierarchy levels and intention. So I'll run through this section. So our amendment sought to the offsetting provisions of Chapter 21 are included in the evidence of Mr. Vivian at page 17 to provide for the consideration of the use of offsetting or environmental compensation for mining activity by considering the extent to which adverse effects can be directly offset or otherwise contemplated, consequently reducing the significance of adverse effects. In considering subsections A, B and C, Section 5, a significant part of this decision is to consider the state of the air and water resources while mining is happening, and once mining ceases, the impact of that on the community. Modern mining methods and adequate offsetting provisions in the plan can ensure that those natural resources are safeguarded for future generations. As described in Mr. Gray's evidence, modern mines rehabilitate and restore the ecosystem after mining to a state that is as good or better than prior to mining.
What decision are you referring to in that paragraph?
Oh, that's Mr. Gray's evidence.
In the second line, I think. A significant part of this decision is that the decision...
Well, your decision.
...out of the wind. Yes,
right,
that's
it. Yes. 5.3. In this context, the term environmental compensation is not used in the RMA. However, the concept usually arises for an applicant for a resource consent does something more than volunteer to avoid, mitigate or remedy direct effects of the proposal. So, offsets and compensation are seen to be something in addition to avoiding, remedying, mitigating. They're a positive offering, if you like, in a package concept. That was initially set out in JFS's Queensland Lakes District Council, which defined it as any action, work services or restrictive covenants to avoid, remedy or mitigate adverse effects of activity in the relevant area, landscape or environment as compensation for the unavoided and unmitigated adverse effects of the activity for which consent has been sought. And the court stated that off-site work or service or covenant that offers environmental compensation for a biodiversity offset will often be a relevant and reasonably necessary measure under Section 104.1i if it meets the following conditions thereafter. I won't read out to you, I suspect you're familiar with those, which have been frequently cited in the offsetting conversation. In the case of Transwest Kingsbury Limited and Kingsbury Regional Council, the court allowed preparation for a new landfill site to remove areas of remnant lowland forests in return for increased protection and maintenance of other larger, enhanced, ecologically more desirable regions as part of a 400-hectare land being turned into a conservation area. And the court stated that overall, the application has been presented to the court as a package. Suitable benefits to the wider environment of Cape Valley and to the region as a whole are proposed as part of this total package. Thus, in any consideration under Part 2 and in the integration necessary under Section 5, these benefits are advanced as a critical feature. The High Court and the Royal Forest and Bird Society case, which is another, considered the relationship between offsetting and mitigation in the context of another mining proposal. Yes, it was Bethurst. The High Court confirms that not all effects need to be addressed by way of mitigation, offset or compensation. It stated that it is clear that Parliament does not intend the RMA to be a zero-sum game, in the sense that all adverse effects which were unavoidable had to be mitigated or compensated. And the other effect of that High Court decision, which confirmed a point that many of us have been debating for some time, is that offsets are not to be treated or classified as mitigation. place that outside of that is a positive environmental effect offered by an applicant to be taken into account as an offset to the adverse effect of the proposal.
Didn't it say residual effects?
It was a somewhat unhelpful decision in the end. So because of my court position, we've got to apply it. It will be in respect of residual effects. It's where you've got a package, we've got a proposal that despite avoiding, remedying, mitigating to the consent, you know, the extent you can, you haven't got the balance right to actually meet the purpose of sustainable management. Mm-hmm. So you need to do something else over here that's a bit separate, that's positive, that wouldn't otherwise be able to be achieved in a positive way, to get the package to the point, the threshold where it makes sustainable management.
And the ones on your right hand here, the biodiversity offsets, and it's environmental compensation in that same category.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
But the part that you referred to earlier where Parliament said about, no, the school's got the RMA over here, and you could potentially, it's not a zero-sum game, there could still be some effect.
Yes, it's also, yeah, so that is a slightly separate point. There still could be, the RMA still contemplates there might be residual adversity. Yeah. Or there might not be, depending on how important the values are that are being affected. If they're actually important values, sometimes it is a requirement that they're going to affect them.
Have you had the opportunity to consider the evidence that the Department of Conservation has presented on offsets
this morning? No, I haven't.
No.
That could have been helpful, wouldn't it?
From the Vardia's evidence.
Braia. Right.
That's right, yes. Yeah. He gave us extensive evidence on this matter and the way that offset should be treated. As he was specifically dealing with biodiversity offsets, but the same principle applies, does it not?
Yes, absolutely.
Even if we're dealing with other offsets for instance, recreational issues or something like that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, paragraphs A and C there, I think, out where offsets fit when resource was sent out, but it's how they would fit under that High Court decision. Section 104.1A allows for taking into account the positive effects on the environment proffered by applicants. Section 104.C allows for consideration of any other method that the authority thinks is relevant and necessary to determine the application. And Section 5.2, which involves the sustainable management. The High Court observes that the parties to the proceeding use the term compensation as a synonym for offset, and that so does the Environment Court in a number of decisions. And the Court expressed the view that compensation should be distinguished from offsets, but couldn't make a finding on the basis that hadn't been argued before. So at the moment, they're still used interchangeably, just a little bit uncomfortable sometimes.
Couldn't possibly
What can be taken from the above line of cases is that offsetting and environmental compensation have been approved of and used synonymously by the Environment Court as a package of measures that together justify granting consent for mining so that the benefits can be obtained. And although most commonly the principles are applied as a concept of biodiversity gains, its application is equally relevant to other environmental aspects such as landscape, where you could have an offset in the form of a following time control program, just for example, heritage values. And this was technically used in terms of oceanic gold operations at Reefton and at Macrae's Flat, where they offer protection, restoration, interpretation and other heritage services that wouldn't otherwise be offered up as heritage offsets, and recreation, such as the creation of a new recreational resource that wouldn't otherwise be there, whether it's an artificial rubber or a walking track or whatever.
Does the no net loss that comes under the biodiversity BBOP, does that apply in terms of how the courts apply these other ones where it's about heritage or recreation?
There's been no robust sort of developmental principles for other for these other types of offsets. There haven't had the same attention, there hasn't been the same debate about them, and so there hasn't been the same set of guidelines. There are no guidelines in that offsetting slash compensation area for any of these types of offsets. So all we're trying to do is make sure that at start, that the concept of an offset or a value other than biodiversity, it's got some credibility in the plan, and then it can be assessed on a case-by-case basis.
And are you including compensation and offset when making that?
That's the intention, is that, yes. I think we've used the word offset in the actual provisions rather than compensation. But at the moment, the terminology that loose compensation may serve the same purpose.
The DOC witnesses this morning produced the guidelines on business biodiversity offsetting programs, which might be quite helpful.
Are they the DOC guidelines?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was...
They are collectively, I'd say. Everyone from London Street in the...
Probably when the producer of the JAC investment case has been reapplied in these subsequent decisions, but maybe sort of modified by that document. I'm not clear on the status of it or sort of industry buy-ins for it. I can't proper an opinion on whether it's an embrace, the document's been embraced by the industry or not. So when I was involved with that a couple of years ago here, it wasn't being embraced by the industry, so I'm just not sure of just how much acceptance it's got across the industry that needs to use it.
I think Mr. Mack from Scriptura addressed this matter.
He would have been most up to date.
The first three areas.
5.12, sorry, I'm not going to move on because my witnesses are more than nine. Finally, it's okay to the submission of New Zealand Tax Centre to provide for an offsetting policy relevant to mining will appropriately ensure future decision makers properly consider offsetting proposals for addressing adverse effects which are broader than biodiversity. Landscape mitigation and the provision of public access are examples of how the policy could be applied in the future. And the addition of this policy will recognise that offsetting can occur from a range of rural-based activities. It's unnecessarily limiting for the plan to only use the concepts within the Indigenous vegetation chapter. The next section on inappropriate in the context of what is thought to be protected, I won't labour, and that just continues the conversation we had in the first hearing stream about better identifying the actual features of ONFs and ONLs to then manage how they should be protected. So it's just a conversation that is carried on from the initial conversation that we were all struggling with collectively in the first hearing stream. And then I summarise the evidence that Mr. Vivian and Mr. Gray are going to give, which you will hear in that talk.
Which you read,
excellent. And conclude that paragraph 8.1 on page 16, mining is an important activity to be recognised within the Queenstown Lakes District. It played a significant role in the bounding of the district, the shaping of its character, heritage and some of its landscapes, and of course provided significant economic benefits. Mining can continue to play its positive role. It is unique as it is consumptive, but also has the ability to better the environment overall for offsetting and mitigation. It is important that the proposed district plan provide recognition by directly acknowledging those important considerations and benefits, and by ensuring the provisions are broad enough for future decision makers to consider applications for appropriate mining activities without unnecessary constraint. In the case of NZTM's operations, there are clear examples of appropriate and important development which cannot be realised by the district that the objectives and policies of the plan require unnecessary hiding of protection or avoidance of adverse effects. So Mr. Gray will be next, and we've got a two-page summary that he'll read out.
Since the 1800s, mining has contributed significantly to the growth and development of the Queenstown Lakes District. Old mining sites now provide the district with a wealth of heritage. The use of modern mining methods, equipment and technology is safer, cleaner and more efficient than in the past. Good planning can remove, avoid and minimise environmental effects of mining. With modern mine management and rehabilitation methods, restoration of the ecosystem after mining to a state that is as good as or better than prior to mining is not only achievable, it is the standard required these days. It is a threshold that needs to be met to obtain approvals and consents. Mining provides the building block for our modern civilization, and the proposed mining of tungsten by New Zealand Tungsten Mining will provide a valued and needed raw material and financial benefit to the local and national economy. Mining is a site-specific activity that can only occur where the minerals are found, and similarly it can only happen when the cycles of economics and demand for the mineral being mined are acceptable. Just as farming and tourism operate in seasonal and economic cycles, mining cycles in response to changing demands for raw materials. These cycles are measured in years, sometimes 5 years, sometimes 50 years. And this is important to realise so that the ability to undertake mining in the future is not blocked by shorter term views and plans. The number of activities that are undertaken as part of the mining cycle are considerable. The exploration and feasibility assessment occurring before mining is undertaken and requiring a significant investment of time and money. It's not unusual for 20 years or more to elapse prior to opening a mine to begin physical mining. These cycles of mining have appeared as the period of resurgence of mining and exploration at Glenorchy. After the discovery of scheelite in the late 1800s, significant mining occurred during and between the World Wars and during the Korean War. Small-scale mining then continued until the early 1980s when the market collapsed. Exploration, drilling and assessment was undertaken by different companies between the late 1960s through until the late 1980s, and NZCM has been exploring and evaluating the results since 2001 up there. As evidence of the long life cycle of mining, there are currently a number of tungsten mines reopened worldwide due to the increasing demand for tungsten. An example of this is the Hemerdon Tungsten Mine in Britain that's reopened to become Britain's first metal mine in over 40 years, providing employment for about 200 people. Just like the Glenorchy Scheelite Mines, the Hemerdon Mine was discovered in the latter part of the 1800s, and a mining of tungsten occurred periodically during the World Wars and the Korean War, when the mine, after which the mine closed. From 1960 to 2006, the exploration was undertaken, and between 2000 and 2011, they undertook feasibility studies, and the mine was reopened in 2014, 57 years after its closure. Mining within the Queenstown Lakes District has historically contributed to the area providing employment and flow-on revenues into the many other industries that mining operations depend on. Future exploration and mining will be the same. The Glenelg and Shiloh deposits have the potential to be internationally and nationally significant, as the proposed mining of tungsten will provide financial benefits to the local and national economy. Additional tourism, visitor experiences, and additional mining heritage sites, and a continuation of the district's rich history of mining. To enable future generations to benefit from the mineral resource assets contained within the district, the district plan needs to recognise the importance of mining to the district and accommodate the long-term cycles involved for mining projects. It's important that the proposed district plan ensures mining and mining-related activities such as exploration are treated in the same manner as other activities and assessed and treated according to the facts and their actual effects, not according to a lack of understanding or incorrect beliefs. Thank you very much.
Now, I've just got one question of clarification on your main brief of evidence. In paragraph 111, you talk about fully rehabilitated fine at the Mokomai Station.
Which number, sorry, was that?
111 on page 2.
Yes.
I just want to clarify, that's the area between Athol and Garston. Is that what we're
doing? I know it's close to Garston. I actually haven't been there since the 90s.
Yeah, no, that's okay. That's actually just outside of our district. It's in Southland.
I've wondered that when I wrote it, actually. Mm,
yeah, no, that's okay.
But I
can't think of one in the district. Can you?
Is Nevis in here?
Sorry?
Nevis. LM's alluvial operations in the 90s. They operate up in the Nevis.
Nevis is outside the district too, isn't it? But the only bit in the district is the very... the confluence.
Oh, yes, most of it's from
Central
Otago.
Yes.
Yeah. You're right.
Mm. Right.
Yeah.
Ross
by the river.
Yes, I can think of two other examples in Central Otago as well, but
no. I thought I was doing well by avoiding the West Coast one.
No, that's okay. No.
We talked about that.
Do you have any questions?
Yeah. That's great. The when you talk about the methods, equipment, technology, safer, cleaner, and more efficient than in the past, can you give some examples of that, particularly in regard to however it is you go about mining tungsten?
Mm. Okay. I'm going to go back to something you mentioned earlier, which is about the tungsten scale of mining.
Yes.
Because it sort of begins from there. The nature of the geology around, and I'll say around the Glenorchy area, which is effectively from here across to the Cranes, Central Otago, is the quite narrow veins which tend to contain, or reef leads to call which contain mineralisation. And as such, that limits the scale and size of mine openings that you can actually physically do, because that's where the goodies are. And so, and my comment about anticipating probably mostly small-scale or underground operations, because there's not enough on the surface of the ground. And underground, it's not big enough to be a big-scale mine, so it's a small-scale operation. So in that respect, the equipment used in reality, it doesn't even differ a whole lot from 100 years ago. It's just got new technology driving behind it, such as we drive typically how it would happen would be a small tunnel driven in and another tunnel driven in and then drilling in between those tunnels. now that can be done using fully automated drills,
right.
Which means that most people actually right up there, they're not handheld. Unless you still stay with old handheld healing drills, which does still happen. In the process, of that, a lot of it, I suppose, is safety issues more outside the realms of here. It's managed. Everything is known. We know where everything is. Water issues, water is controlled. There's no unknown runoffs of water.
It's dry drilling. That's a question, sorry.
There's water used in the drilling process.
Yes. So called
the
drill head.
That's pressed dust.
Right, yep.
Yeah, which is very important. That's another thing. I think the silicosis of the lung will not be occurring because people won't be working in environments of dusty environments.
When you say small scale, what, and big scale, could you give me an idea since I have none?
Yes, well, a tunnel is 2.5 meters high, or diameter,
right.
I was told myself, and it's...
How can you get down and across, or how do you go to the side of a hill? How long is the tunnels? The run scenes or whatever that you're looking at.
At Glenorchy, they have historically been tracked for up to 1,000 metres, and at the Glenorchy, heritage landscape, they are fairly much horizontal to 10 or 15 degrees off horizontal.
Mm-hmm.
So the old timers have just basically come in on the horizontal and then have another tunnel a bit further away, and then they had a network of tunnels. They really just mine the tunnels rather than what's in between them. So that's where like the efficiencies of mining, which comes back to money, is that if you can actually, in one blast, take between two tunnels, you've got an awful lot more rock for the cost of developing those tunnels. Does that answer your question?
Now, how do you stop? If you take the bit out in the middle, what stops the... I don't know how far apart are the tunnels. So how much?
Say 10 metres.
All right. And so the
if you go in
hill doesn't collapse down into the tunnel? Or?
No, because there's a private land, there's a landowner upstairs that
says
you're not allowed to. And you can't go in the ground at the moment, but if we get in to do some work, we will be able to set up a nice little operation you can do this.
Right.
And then you'll see them at 20 metre wide. Into 20 metre wide old stopes, they call them, in between those areas, which have been sitting up there for 50 years, 70 years, just sitting there. And the wooden timbers that rock away, you'll see, to hold it up and interest that.
What sort of equipment do you have on the outside or above ground in terms of these small scale mines that you're referring to?
Above ground, the most is roads. Access to the entrances, which would then have trucks to carry rock, which would probably be, let's just say, trucks of the size of your normal, say, 10 road truck, dump truck.
Truck and trailer.
Yeah, 10 to 20 tons, because the countryside's relatively steep in most of the areas, and so you can't really have large. Okay. I don't anticipate it quite true because of the environment, because of where it's at. I don't see any major surface development. There's a fan on the surface. Need for workshop, which is fine. Because the machinery is not underground, so it's not large surface equipment. It always can fit them through that tunnel.
And Shoelite mines. When you said Glenorchy, you said Glenorchy from McCrae's. Is that how far you mean, or do you mean the Fergal Upper?
I sort of mean is that the geology, which is McCrae's.
Oh, right. So it's just the geology is called that rather than the location.
And then the lines of these veins carrying on through. Now, if there's one big vein, I think that'd be gone.
Yeah. Sorry, what I mean is, when you're referring, where in the district do these veins occur?
Okay.
Providing I'm not asking trade secrets.
No, that's all independent. No, I've got no secrets, really. We have three permits. There are two exploration permits. The hierarchy goes from prospecting to exploration to mining. No rights of access comes with either of those. We have a prospecting permit which pretty much runs from up the Richardson Mountains from halfway between Queenstown and Greenwalkie up to the old Redwood Small Mine just on the border of the National Park up there. And with two exploration permits, one is centred over the old Greenwalkie State Mine area, if you've been up there, east of Greenwalkie.
Mm.
It's where they were gathered, so there was a state nationalised country mine in the Second World War that came over and it's operated there. And another exploration permit at the northern end of Mount Alfred, which is as a relatively outstanding natural feature. And we question. In that area, so within both of those exploration permits, there's quite extensive mineralisation of veins which are up to 2 metres thick, containing historically low, based on historic, of amounts of tungsten which are on a world scale. I'll give you a number that the Hemerdon mine that's opened up in Britain is mining. Tungsten of 0.1% concentration, and it all gets about 1%, so it's 10 times the concentrations, if you like, of the valuable metal that's there.
So the rest of it, let's say it's 1 cubic metre, and you're getting 1% of that, then 99% is redundant. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and so when you take the scheelite out, where does it get processed into tungsten?
The process for processing it is a gravity process, which I think is called to alluvial gold processing plant.
Right.
So you basically crush it into as small as you have to, less than 2 millimetres down, and the density of the scheelite is more than twice the density of the schist rock around it. So it's pretty much heavier, and just using
Methods
of Geiger gold, Glabrick gold, and
Precision
chip check.
So you, in terms of if you were doing this, and in terms of the mining activities that the plane might provide for, does it include all of the processing of it, so that what you're taking out is just tungsten, or is it just the digging it out of the ground and getting it up to the surface and then trucking it somewhere else?
Yeah, so I know where it's going, and it's where does all the waste rock go to as well. We've got two exploration permits. One of them is located northern end of Mount Alfred, which becomes a dark beach on the western side, dark ridge where the jet boats go up. And that is a place which we are hoping to be able to establish a gravity processing plant there for the Shearless mine on Mount Alfred. We have farmers' agreements, we need another business department up there, we're waiting on there, so that's quite a shock, it's quite a complex thing. So that's in a way quite a simple place. And I'm talking a processing plant, size of this room. We're talking quite small scale things. The other at the Greenwalkie permit is a little bit tricky because the access to that conservation land, there is no legal road access to that land anymore because the land tender has been passed that on to the current owner. So depending on how much tungsten is there, this is how much it's worth, is what you can do to it. So an option would be a containerized processing plant. You process it there to yet the concentrate, which is actually probably about one step off that at the time, and what the remainder is your crushed up rock, which is what some streams and mine water, etc. So would I be backfilled under the mine or into the mine, which would help that support issue before, or if the allocation was there to form a landform to what we call overground storage areas, waste dumps. Tailing dumps, they used to call them.
Having done all that, explained, which is good, is it your intention that in terms of the changes you're seeking to the plan would include all of it would be both the mining and that processing? Or is that a question I should
be asking? I think it comes back to the definitions.
Yeah.
Mining activities in the Crown Minerals Act does include associated processing of the rock, yes. Where that goes. Worst case scenario is you put on the truck, you drive the equipment down, and you set up a place out in the industrial zone and we'll process it here.
The end product of concentrated tungsten, what happens to that?
At the moment, we're buyers, we have Austrian from the concentrate, which is to go to somewhere who's got a refinery plant which can basically melt, process and melt the tungsten out to get the tungsten metal or make the tungsten carbide, which is like our customers and things like that. So, and that amount is, like you say, it's 1% of originals to get more numbers, but a mine which might mine 100,000 tons per rock a year, which is 30-something thousand cubic metres, which is actually really quite small, would then be sending only 1,000 tons of stuff away, and a 44-gallon drum weighs 1 ton. So I'm sending a truck a week, basically, is what we go as the concentrate. So there's small numbers of actual quantity. And if we can crack the processing, we can make it into a final product.
And then, given that you're an expert in mining, I think, other than just this particular tungsten type, the kind of things that you're seeking in the plan could apply equally to anybody mining any metal?
This is where I put on my, I never thought I'd be a stay mining engineer, but I actually become quite passionate about it. And that I just see that our entire civilization is here because of it. And so it's not just full tungsten mining, it's actually full mining per se.
Would you include aggregates in that?
I work on a 2 million ton a year aggregate quarry at the moment. It is a mine, but I have all the quarries. Dollar rock is probably the dollar rock that's worth money.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gray. Are there any existing tungsten mining operations in New Zealand at the moment?
There's none.
When was the last time?
There's only ever been some small mines north, South Island, and south of Otago. Apart from those, most productions come from here north. And the last would be 1980 or 1983, depending on which of the people you talk to, you say they were the last ones up there mining it. But you can say early 1980s. and that was small scale open cast bulldozers pushing sides of the hills off type mining not underground.
Okay. And what kind of volume would you have to extract in total in order for it to become economically viable at the 1% that we might find at Whanauke?
Because that changes on a market today basis, but I'll say 50,000 tonnes of rock, so say 500 tonnes of the concentrate. This is still going public, isn't it? and that's just because you start working with multiples of teams of people actually mining, because at the end of mining becomes quite a practical thing about real people doing things, and you can't have 1.5 people, 7.5. So that's a number, and then so you get like multiples of that in amount as well.
Okay, I'm just trying to get it in my head with that. So it's about 5,000 truckloads you need to move around to make something like that.
Between some trucks.
Okay, so
truck an hour,
yeah.
Basically, through my ballpark numbers.
So the equivalent of a small sort of quarrying type operation?
Yeah, it'd be a very small quarrying operation, that's right, yeah.
Okay. And on this wider notion of offsetting, environmental offsetting, it was in Baker Galloway's submission, so I don't know who wants to answer, but are there any mining sites in New Zealand that have been returned to the current kind of version of fully rehabilitated, as opposed to what might have happened 20 or 30 years ago?
I suppose you could almost look at the Glenorchy mines area, which is actually, you can't, those 1980s roads, which they build roads, you can't hardly see those anymore. You know, those are the roads back, the plants are back there. My clients operate as far as biodiversity offsetting, I mean, they've made some significant advances for the surrounding environment, but it's not a rehabilitation of what this mine.
So in a modern sense, what other kind of techniques might be used in terms of offsetting? Is it just returning access back to that place and putting plants back in where the ground was disturbed, or are there other programs in terms of access?
What would I expect to be done? Yes, I would expect, being on the mining hat, that pest control is always going to come up there at the top of the list to actually. With the egrets, I do a lot of work for them, and that their pests involved. This is their website, in fact. The biodiversity coordinator is actually running the quarry now, and this is quite good. And you know, it has an effect over a much larger area than just this little area of the mine. And replanting, we've already done a gecko lizard survey to check things out, make sure that they're not there. Replanting, and even roadways can be put back exactly as they were, all better before. One of the things that I see is that the impacts the effects are actually really quite minimal and short, so it's not just pretend. We're going through the same big process at the moment to start drilling in the heritage area, and there is minor, less than minor effects. There really is no negative effects there to actually deal with. Buildings can be removed. Offsetting the heritage is going to become the interesting thing, but it's a place to discuss heritage here.
Well, we will be back for the heritage
chat. Yeah, in terms of offsetting, it's what's heritage is, what's useful. I'd rather see a really
nicely run mine that tourists can actually go, people, visitors can go into it and actually see it. She like goes in an ultraviolet light, it's very pretty, it's very nice, and it would be great. So it's an offset, but it's just here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just interested in terms of possibly giving Glenorchy as an example, what kind of engagement with the local communities with the formalisation of the
Yes.
Yep.
To date, nothing to like covertly out there in terms of saying we're here, but I would say we're in communication with most people out in that community who live there for longer than 10 years actually know what we're doing. The key farmers, the key people there, we're that's deep with what we're doing. It's a small community and we're just to go. So we've been exploring it for, say, 2001, so it's been a long, drawn-out process. And the next step, when we do actually have access arrangements and consents finalised, then we will actually be able to say, this is what we are going to do, we are going to go and do this, and then there will be a different story in terms of establishing it. There will be a shop run and a helicopter shop, or it's just a place for people to contact. Actually just going in and spending time there is actually a way to meet most people.
So there will be a sort of, I guess, educational component to what you're doing. I know you're saying what you're talking about, but for the locals...
Interesting, most of the locals that I think are like is, the fourth generation. It's pretty rare to meet someone up there whose grandfather or uncle didn't work in the Sheila mine. It's not like past history, it's still alive for them. As far as the there's perception, I mean, it's what business partners said yesterday, is people are against mining. They're really against bad mining, but there's a difference. And perception.
That's right, no, that's good, thank you. One of the other questions I had, just following on from Commissioner Coombs, was in terms of offsetting, your paragraphs 2.1 and 3 talk about enabling future generations to benefit from mineral resource assets. Have you ever seen any of the offsetting go on as far as, I guess, looking at alternative technologies and how the mining industry could, I guess, invest in alternative technologies that move away from non-finite resource?
You mean mining without mining?
Yeah.
So I don't understand that.
So in terms of offsetting, I guess, how broad does that go in terms of the social economic benefits? Really was. And you ever seen an example of a really innovative offset that didn't just look at the land that it was on, but actually a broader social economic benefit?
So, I wasn't going to bring back to the community.
Yeah.
Nothing, and this is not pretend. I mean, every mining company relies on its local community. I don't think there's a single one that doesn't actually contribute back to the local sports clubs, the sports teams, the schools. Town of Ross is a good little example for a similar sized town on the Ross and West Coast, South Street. Birchfield, which is like us, and you're looking at myself and my business partner behind me. This is change. This is New Zealand comes to mind. This is all there is, but it's not like a big corporate out there backing us up. So getting in close with the people that you work with is really important. And they actually really quite look forward to getting moving and to actually be able to make that contribution to something that's up there, for instance, in the school. So, we ask this person, what do you need? They're a part of the job, they want a job, but they want the school, contributions to the school, this one wants something in there. I can send you a lot of information. Why you go and you take the other extreme, I suppose, to a large scale, there, the whole visitor centre, the school trips which go there, to educate and understand, and visitors to there, everywhere there's a mine, there's a visitor centre, because people are actually really very interested in the mining, you know, the objectives of the consensus on the Ross Gold mine. Well, they ended up setting up the visitor centre right next to it, so you can look at the mine, they kept it going for many years. If I'm going on track, just tell me.
No, that's a good example.
Doc of the reopeners. Mine's on the West Coast now, yeah, they're in the business. I mean, they've got mines up here in Penalty, which we're not allowed to go into, but all the tourists do go into. I get really stuck. I keep looking at all the negatives and for your job. So it's like the technology question, I keep looking. And I just can't see it. And not just for this school thing, but just actually mining in general. I mean, I had an interview a while back for a newspaper who asked me when a section 4 review came around. And so the big picture is he asked me, well, what about all the environmental disasters? So I saw from Minara down to New Zealand in the last 100 years, which would take. And there has been no environmental disasters that I actually know of in terms of mining. It's actually not as bad as what people think.
Alright, we'll move on to Mr. Vivian. Possibly, fortunately, he hasn't seen a summary, because at least you want to hear something.
The first crack at Mr. Vivian last week, so now we'll focus on the first part of evidence.
So do you confirm your name as Karen Vivian, and you prepare to bring the evidence that is February 2015 for the purpose of the hearing?
Yes.
Do you have any corrections you want to make?
No, I've already made some corrections.
Okay. Do you confirm it's true and correct?
Yes.
And we express your opinion on that opinion based on your experience and expertise?
Yes.
Thank you.
Vivian, afternoon. I want to go to 4.32 of your evidence. Just in terms of the amendment to the policy, it seems to be changed. It's changing from manage to from control to manage, and you note that it's got additional words manager there, but it's manage it to what end is what I'm trying to understand.
Okay, so my recommendation to the policy is to manage the location and type of non-farm activities in the rural zone in order to minimise or avoid conflict with activities that may not be compatible with permitted or established activities. So, the question is...
If I was to change the one in 4.32, you're taking out the second manage,
yes,
and inserted the words in order to...
Yes.
Right, yeah.
Yes, correct.
Okay.
I think, Mr. Vivian, it would assist Commissioner Sinclair if you would point him to where in your appendix I find it difficult when I was reading, especially electronically, you go back and forward to the right page, but
that part of it, usually include the memory of it, so just ran out of time.
Yes.
Attachment A, 21.3, comment C, A, second comment down.
Okay, thank you. I might have got it tripped up on the same one here, 21.25, the objective.
Yes, so 21.25, so that top line, Mr. Bauer made some recommended changes to it, and then underneath I put a clean version of it to try and make better sense of it.
Even so, it's just my hobby horse of having objectives that actually state the environmental outcome or an end state, the goal of which you're trying to reach. So I suppose in terms of the purpose of the objective, what is it that can you verbalise for what it is you're trying to achieve?
And the purpose of that objective is to enable sustainable mining, essentially. It doesn't have significant adverse effect on water quality or landscape conditions, education, etc.
So it's to have providing mining is carried on so that those effects don't occur.
Correct.
Yeah. Paragraph 4.54. So in terms of that objective there, which that objective, where it talks about an objective is to acknowledge something, just because you acknowledge it doesn't provide an end state of the goal. It's not an environment, acknowledgement of it is not an environmental outcome.
Yes, I agree with you here. Is the same goes for recognised. The original policy statement is access to mineral resources.
I mean, I've got, in terms of the RPS, in fact, that's the proposed RPS, that's also my next question in regard to those ones there, and just in regard to if there's those provisions you refer to, this is in 4.53 to 4.58, you refer to the provisions of the operative RPS, and just with what we were discussing with Ms. Baker Galloway earlier, just do you have a view in terms of how those provisions are provided, or we'd need to give effect to those given what the current version of the proposed regional plan It's,
yeah, it's a difficult one because I guess the plan at the moment recognises that there historically has been one. It doesn't go so far as to recognise the potential for future mining. When I say mining, I'm putting gravel extraction for road construction, etc. set to the side. Things that we should not. The plan certainly doesn't recognise those mineral deposits within the bank. And I guess it's been just policy was aimed at to recognise it but not identify it because it's pretty hard for the bank to identify the mineral deposits.
In terms of the offsetting, and we discussed that again earlier as well, are you aware of any plans within New Zealand where things such as heritage or landscape offsetting or that's or compensation that's actually been identified in those plans as examples that we might be able to look at?
In terms of mining?
In terms of mining or offsetting for what I suppose could be mining, but it could be anything else. Power stations, I don't know.
Yeah,
not for resource consent, but where it's in the plane.
I sort of work around the south of Depot, Bagups and McKenzie.
Yep.
So I'm not too familiar with north of McKenzie, but certainly, nothing in any of those things to my recollection. The Queenstown plan, I guess, is a little bit more advanced than most of those things in the US.
Give everyone else the opportunity to comment on the difference between compensation and offsetting. Do you have a view?
Yeah, I pretty much see it as pretty much the same thing in terms of the net result. For example, I was involved in the SAS investment case before the Environment Court, and that compensation was put forward as offsetting, but then I'm pretty much sure I think it came back to compensation in the decision book, of course. So, I pretty much see that it's the same thing.
Could you help me out? It's just that I couldn't quite understand 488 through to 492. This was in regard to farm buildings, and sorry.
Yeah.
Present buildings on in rural areas other than farm buildings, and in terms of the policy, I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand what you were getting at here.
Yeah, the concern was that if you made the rules easier for farm buildings, then people would build a farm building
and either use that as a receiving environment argument to then convert it to residential.
Mm-hmm.
And the court imposed something into the plan which said basically that you can't use an existing argument, either a committed baseline argument or a receiving environment to convert into something else. And I guess what I'm saying is that mining buildings were given the same status as farm buildings, then that same thing should apply, i.e. that can't be used for accommodation.
Right, and my understanding isn't for farm buildings per se, that piece you said about excluding the use of the permitted baseline has been continued through to this plan, the proposed plan, in terms of farm buildings?
Yes, provision 21.337, which I mentioned, is 4.87.
And so your issue here is that if we were, there's a request to have it that mining buildings as well as farm buildings and therefore the same should apply. So there's two parts to that.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, that's very clear. Nothing further from me, thank you.
You did have a question for me earlier, the difference between open-class mining and tunnel mining. I've given a little bit of thought to the errors still. If you look at the landscape assessment criteria, I think, which is attached to that, you go through a step of, let's say the mining was to occur in the ONR or ONF, you go through a step of criteria looking at landscape quality, character, and effects on visual landscape. I think if you go through that logically, an open cast mine would be treated very differently to a tunnel mine or whatever. So naturally, I think going through that assessment criteria, the two activities would be treated very differently.
Would the same happen if you went through the policies first?
Not to the same extent, no. But, yeah,
is that a weakness in the policy, therefore?
In some respects, yes. Definitely the assessment criteria are far more detailed.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Levy. Turning to paragraph 4.66 of your evidence, you're talking about a proposed objective from the NZTML submission, and you discussed the idea of softening the wording there from encourage to consider the use of offsetting or environmental compensation for mining. In light of the questioning of Mr. Gray and the various methods which he suggested could be used for offsetting, do you think for an activity like this we should be encouraging rather than just considering?
It's interesting to say that I see you going from encourage to consider as strengthening the policy as opposed to weakening it.
Although, surely, considering something, you could think about it and then discard the idea, but encouraging it actually requires some action.
As a discretionary activity, means you have to do it. Certainly when I was making a recommendation, I thought my opinion was would consider would be stronger than encourage.
Okay, so the strongest version of the word in which you were making
that would certainly encourage that.
Okay. Thank you.
Unintended.
No.
I had a question on that same policy, and I'm just wondering whether there should be some setting up of the circumstances as to when austerity was to occur, as opposed to avoiding, remedying or mitigating.
Mm.
Yes, well, I guess you could add into that policy, where recreational activities, for example, could be affected, heritage values.
The evidence we've heard on biodiversity offsetting has suggested that biodiversity offsetting should only occur when avoidance, remediation or mitigation is not possible. Do you consider that that should be the same situation in these other forms of offsetting, such as for recreation or heritage or something like that?
Yes, I'm just certainly encourage kids to be mitigated.
Well, sometimes they can be avoided, can't they?
Yeah, but if they can't be avoided.
Mm. Oh, no, I was thinking there must be a scale, though. A scale if one goes down.
Yes. I'm just thinking of that experience in business case where the compensation or offsetting was to donate to the council's wild and tree control to start with tree control from the outlines and then bring it back to the site in terms of the wild. And that was a definite benefit of the proposal. Yet the proposal was still bound by the court to be at no more than 9 cents. So in that case, the compensation, it wasn't within the compensation for avoiding per se. So, yeah.
Well, it sounds to me like the court decided it was avoided. They concluded it had any minor effect. I'm just thinking, I think of a situation where, for instance, and hypothetically, there is a heritage building, and which is possible in a particular circumstance, and you need an access road that goes around the building, that avoids it. So it's impossible to go around it. It may be possible to only damage it slightly, which is mitigation. Mm-hmm. It may be possible for it to be temporary, in which case it can be remediated, although certain members of ECOWAS might not be happy with that. Or, in the final case, you have to go right through the middle of it, so you've got some sort of offset. Mm. That I'm trying to understand, is that the approach that you think it should be, or you just go straight to offsetting and don't worry about considering the other options?
No, I see where you're coming from there. I agree with that. That should be avoided.
And
So then, if this policy we considered appropriate, we would be wise to draft it consistent with the way the biodiversity offsetting policies are drafted. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Vivian, I have one other question that I meant to ask earlier that you may have. In terms of the mining and applying for consents and that kind of thing, if it was in old mining tailings and that kind of thing, would it require consent under the NPS for contaminated land?
Yes, it would be. It would be considered a hail site. So, here's one of my answers. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Davis Consulting, who did the resource consent application, that not through that for the they invested in that resource consent application. And in that particular case, actually, it wasn't a contaminated site after a PU site or. But they did address it.
Now, paragraph 457. This policy that's quoted here, is that the one that you, the wording that you consider appropriate, or is it? Which page of section A is it?
Page 21.
Sorry.
Which page of appendix A is it?
21.3.
Sorry, 21.3.
Yeah, comment 10. So, yes, it is the same.
I just wondered, in this district, where the mineral resources are pretty widespread in their general sense and utilised in their general sense, whether that might be a little bit inhibiting another development.
I guess as the resource, the potential of the resources throughout the district, but where the actual mining or mineral extraction takes place, there is some in the Wakatobi Basin, and it's very in certain areas, under the remarkables that shot over the four prospecting public areas and then in Glenorchy. So.
But what about the other forms of mineral extraction, such as quarrying for aggregates and for schist?
Schist is only one place in the basin. It's at,
but it's not the only location for the resources. And
well,
that's what I wonder about.
There's different grades of schist that they use for construction. There's a place out of Whitechapel that they have lower grade stuff, but most of the stuff comes from Cromwell somewhere for local construction. But they sort of say that there isn't a single schist in the basin, tell me that there's a ground that could be used for construction. I wonder if the word nod, mineral resources.
That might assist.
Yes.
Paragraph 451. Now, I'm not sure if this is carried through in your conclusion, but the third, on the top of page 15, the third policy down, manage any waste heaps or long-term stockpiles to ensure they're compatible with forms in the landscape. Would it be appropriate to have an emphasis on using any of that rock to the extent practical first?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was actually thinking about that. Gary was talking about it in terms of the 99% that you're throwing away, being able to use the road in more construction. And
sounds to me it's about the size of sand.
Finer.
Yeah.
If it can be done. Is there a practical use for that?
We have looked at it as far as it's used for concrete and you have chemistry issues, how it reacts with cement, because that brick making depends very much where the market is and what the use is. And it was actually good at work, but most of it is quite in down there, so it's a sand size, so it does have the potential for more facility use and finer.
And my final question is paragraph 443. That's the objective that we've already discussed.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Any other questions? Thank you.
In that case, I'll adjourn the hearing.
See you tomorrow morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.